The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Chris, good morning. Love your show. You and Eddie are the dynamic duo.
I have a very hard time finding any news source that I can trust, so I'm very grateful to have this listened to on the way to work.
No, I don't think it should be mandatory. I wouldn't demand to be mandatory, but I would do everything in my power. It's like I don't think masks have to be made mandatory nationwide.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Okay, I heard you already. All right, you know, I'm just relaying the news, folks. It's not me. Don't shoot the messenger. How many times have I had to tell you that? Telephone number 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Bunch of you mad at me yesterday, which is nothing new these days. It feels like everybody's ticked off about something, and I did it, even though I didn't do it. You people have the luxury of just sitting out there and being pissed off. And I appreciate that. It's the holidays. Why wouldn't you be? I'm just having a little fun. But everybody's mad because the midterms didn't turn out the way they wanted. And as such, people are looking for somebody to blame and be mad at. Everybody's mad. I hear you. I get it. Believe me. Ain't nobody feels it more than me. But now everybody's looking at every little grievance, everything they hear, even if it comes from this radio station or this show or this podcast that I do, somebody that I have on the show. Did you hear what he said? Why are you allowing him to? Despite what you may think, I do not control everything that emanates out of your speakers. I don't. I wish I did. Yes, I am a benevolent dictator. And between the hours of 6 and 9 in Philadelphia, I am in charge of this show to a degree. However, we do still take breaks. We go to commercial, and as such, when we go to commercial, there are commercials that I don't control. We go to news, and there's news that I don't control. It comes out of Washington, D.C., right? So there are things, there are elements that aren't in my immediate control. We host guests on the show that say things that I may not control, and you may not like. And I either don't catch, don't pick up on, or feel like, well, I'll just kind of let that sit and let the smartest audience that I know of decide whether they like it or not. But every now and again, a convergence of these things happens. And yesterday, there are people that are convinced that I was doing an anti-Trump show. And I have to come here today again and remind you, this is going to be my life, Fast Eddie, for the next 2 years, trying to remind people that I am not picking a horse in the primary, and I am not telling you how to feel or what to think about Donald Trump, or that I think Donald Trump is yesterday's news or damaged goods. Or I will tell you when that is becoming the conventional wisdom. I will point out when it seems that everybody is singing from that hymnal. I will ask questions of guests along those lines to see how they respond. Now, if you don't like their response, stipulated. I get it. But I have made a policy here. I'm not talking people into or out of Donald Trump. I'm not doing it.
Chris, I mean, I'm glad you brought this up because honestly, I'm getting the opposite calls. Now I'm saying, you're sounding Trumpy. And it's just like, what? What?
If that's what they're saying, then that's very good news.
Oy.
That we're doing our jobs out there. I'm not trying to be cute. I think there are people out there that think, yeah, you sincerely believe one thing, and you're just not telling us. No, I don't. When I tell you, I hear both sides of the argument on this Trump thing. I do. I can easily make a legitimate case that both sides are making to me every day about why it's probably time to turn the page and thank Trump for all of his work. But it's going to be a tough sled to get him back to the White House. And I can also hear people that say he's the only guy and nobody else will even come close to mustering the kind of base support and enthusiasm that he has. I hear that, and I also believe that's likely very true. I know you're out there shouting, DeSantis, DeSantis. Listen, do I think that people are going to come home ultimately? I do, but I can't risk that. Listen, I would have thought we wouldn't be in a place where there's a special election in Georgia today. Well, it's not a special election. It's an election now to either coronate this Warnock guy or toss him to the curb, courtesy of Herschel Walker. We shouldn't be here. Raphael Warnock should not be a United States senator. And do you know why he is? I remember why. It was at this very place, not but 2 years ago, a year ago. When was it? When was the Georgia special election, the runoff? It was right after Trump lost in 2020. And 2 months later, down in Georgia, what happened? Sidney Powell happened. The Kraken happened. And everybody lost their minds and started pouting and screaming and yelling that the election was rigged. And guess what? Nobody showed up in Georgia. And everybody pouted. And we got the Lord of the Rings attorneys, Ossoff and Warnock. And we lost control of the United States Senate. Now, folks, I'm just going to tell you the truth here. Everybody's so bummed out and dispirited and ticked off after another election cycle. I don't like making predictions here, but I have a funny feeling we're set up for that to happen again today. Herschel Walker versus Raphael Warnock, special election. It's not going to surprise me if Warnock ends up running away with it. He leads big time in early voting, according to what I'm reading, anyway. Now, you and I don't, you know, we don't have anything to do with what's going on in Georgia, so we sit and we watch it. And it really doesn't matter. At this point, control of the Senate no longer matters. So it's just now a matter of degrees. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if, much like 2020, a bunch of Georgia Republicans just sit home and pout. I get it. Everybody's ticked off. Nobody thinks there's any reason to show up and vote anymore. I hear you. I understand. And now everybody either wants to declare Trump dead or not. Now, listen, I will be honest with you. I even pointed this out. Fast Eddie, did I not point out to you that when we went to break, we play news breaks here during the top of the hour that come out of our network? They are Washington, D.C. based newscasts. Did I not say to you during the break? Now, I didn't make a big deal about it at the time because these are my, Salem Media Group, my employer. The people that cut my checks here, they've been great partners and friends ever since I started the show here. They have never once, not once in any way, shape, matter, or form, said so much as boo to me about the way I conduct my show. They've never been anything but the best. They've never been anything but supportive. They have never shown any inkling to be partisan or left-leaning. There's none of that. I mean, in fact, I've heard it's the opposite. We've been accused in the New York Times, Salem has, of being this right-wing cabal, the last corporate entity standing. There was a serious piece written about what's going on over there at Salem not too terribly long ago about how we were all a bunch of black hat-wearing arch-conservative wackos that needed to be maybe even investigated for being so crazy. Anybody doubt Sebastian Gorka's bona fides, for instance, when it comes to his support for Trump? I think he made that clear on this show. So having said all that, I was rather surprised. And did I not say it to you in private? You know, I'll divulge now a private conversation that I had with Fast Eddie when we went to break during the show yesterday that I did not have on the air. But what did I say to you? Yeah, about a newscast that aired yesterday?
Yeah, he said, did you hear the end of that news report? And I'm like, I honestly hadn't noticed. And yes, it was it. Oh, the specific with the. Was it, did they bring up Mar-a-Lago?
They led, the newscast led with Trump's Truth Social.
Post calling for, quote, calling for a suspension of the Constitution. And then they coupled that with his dinner with Kanye at Mar-a-Lago.
Right. That's right. Was the punchline. Yes.
Did I not? What did I say? Do you remember? I mean, it was a brief passing thing. We were busy yesterday, so you may not even remember this. But I listen to everything, folks. I'm eagle-eyed. I'm always watching. And when I heard it, I got it at Fast Eddie's ear, and I said, did you hear that? Did you hear that news break? And we're busy doing other stuff, so we're not always listening to every minute of the news break. You know, we're getting coffee or taking a comfort stop, as one of my favorite travel agents used to say. May not always hear it, but I heard it. I heard our Salem media headquarters news anchors from Washington, D.C., sounding distinctly, what do you want to say?
It was a surprising admission to their newscast. It was a surprising addition. And, of course, yeah, my first question to you is, what does that mean?
Right. What does that mean? Who's making that? Somebody's making an editorial call to throw a little extra something in that newscast. Now, it's one thing to do the news, which was the news, which was Trump put up something on Truth Social that has a bunch of conservatives' heads on fire, thinking that Trump called for the suspension of the Constitution. That's a news story. That's a legit story. I mean, we addressed it with Sean Spicer on the show yesterday. Now, throwing in there for good measure, as if to pile on, this comes right after he has dinner with Kanye West and anti-Semites. What? Whoa, that was like a week ago. What, who threw that thing in there? All of a sudden now it feels like you're piling on Salem News headquarters. So some of you eagle-eyed listeners heard that, and I did too. And I don't know what. Look, folks, I don't know how to explain it. I asked Sean Spicer about it, and Sean said to me yesterday, he's my friend. Of course he can win, but sometimes you want to help your friend. And I was bombarded yesterday by people saying, what the hell kind of show are you running? What's going on over there? When did you become an anti-Trump show? What the hell? I said, easy. What did you hear me say? And of course, as always, when pressed on it, you don't hear me say anything anti-Trump. Then people said, why don't you just read what he wrote? Instead of making up what he wrote, why don't you just read? I have been reading what he wrote. I'll read it again if you don't like. And now, listen, I will stipulate. Some of you have wanted it's like a review in football. Some of you have thrown the challenge flag and you want this reviewed. Review what he read or what he wrote, Stigall. Review it. Okay, we'll review it. I'm happy to. Those of you who said he called for a suspension of the Constitution. People said, read. Okay, fine. Here's what he said. So with the revelation of massive and widespread fraud and deception in working closely with big tech companies, the DNC and the Democrat Party, do you throw the presidential election results of 2020 out and declare the rightful winner? Or do you have a new election? Question mark. Now, to be fair, that's a question. He offered a hypothetical question in his Truth Social post. He then said, a massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. Our great founders did not want and would not condone false and fraudulent elections. Now, to be clear and fair, I will say what a number of you were protesting and throwing the challenge flag on yesterday. You are, on a technicality, correct. Donald Trump did not call for the overthrowing of the government. He did not call for Joe Biden to be tossed. He did not call to be installed. He did not call for a suspension of the Constitution. It is also correct to say he brought it up. So here we are again on this technicality, and I explained to a number of you who emailed me in a rage yesterday, folks, we're going to be doing this for the next 2 years, just as we did it since 2015. Trump is a Rorschach test, and you're going to see Trump and the way Trump speaks and the things Trump writes in the view of the lens that you feel about Trump. And so if you choose to see this as Trump is saying this is so egregious, why not? It's rhetorical. That everything he just said is rhetorical. He's throwing it out there to be conversational. He's entering it into the mix. He's saying, listen, with this kind of fraud, what's the Constitution matter? He's being provocative. He's not calling for anything. Those of you who want to move on from Donald Trump and think Donald Trump is cancerous and toxic and just cost us the midterms, because everybody's pissed off about the midterms. Everybody wants to blame somebody on the midterms. And one of the easiest, fastest scapegoats to blame for the midterms is Donald Trump, as we know and we've talked about. And so when Trump has dinner with Kanye, or when Trump writes something like this, those of you who feel like some of this is Trump's fault and Trump is making things worse and Republicans can't win without Trump, you're ready to pile on him and declare his candidacy and his presidency and his tenure dead and done. You see, we can't. This guy is he just had dinner with Kanye, and now on top of that, now he's calling for a suspension of the Constitution. And you people that love him say, that's not what he said. He just said that if we're going to just throw out all the rules and cheat, then what the hell's the Constitution mean? And he's right. Well, this got so heated yesterday. I mean, this got so intense. And, you know, people, again, his great friend and former press secretary, his first press secretary, who's arguably taken more slings and arrows than any of them for Trump because he was the first one. It got so intense that Trump finally had to address this. And he went back on Truth Social and he wrote this. Does anybody notice that the lamestream media is refusing to report about even a simple mention the biggest election integrity and interference scandal in our country's history? Watch closely. You will see barely a mention. We have a corrupt media, the likes of which has never before been seen. But we will make America great again. And a little later, scrolling on his posts here, fake news is now trying to convince the American people that I wanted to terminate the Constitution, he wrote. This is simply more disinformation and lies, just like Russia, 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 and all their other hoaxes and scams. What I said was that when there is a massive and widespread fraud and deception, as has been irrefutably proven in the 2020 election, steps must be taken to right the wrong. Only fools would disagree with that and accept stolen elections. MAGA. Simply put, he wrote again, if an election is, and this is all caps now because he really means it. Simply put, if an election is irrefutably fraudulent, it should go to the rightful winner or, at a minimum, be redone. Where open and blatant fraud is involved, there should be no time limit for change. So, it does seem that while he is angry, people would suggest that he was actually meaning we should suspend the rules of the Constitution, he does again say, now that we know the election is fraudulent, it should go to the rightful winner or at a minimum be redone. So in one sense, he's clarifying, no, I did not call for a suspension of the Constitution, but then turns right around and says, but we should absolutely install the rightful winner if we find that an election was fraudulent, which is, there's no rule book for that, folks. That is, I mean, I don't know how to break it to you, but we don't have a game plan for that in the country. There's nothing that says if fraud has been determined, we can install the rightful winner. Once the election's been certified, it's been certified. I mean, that is the system. It sucks. Everybody knows that Kennedy, you know, versus Nixon, there was massive cheating and ballot box stuffing in Chicago. Many people question to this day that John Kennedy ever won the presidency. But he did, and it was certified, and that's that. I mean, he did, air quotes. The thing is, once Congress certifies an election, which you may remember we had that little hiccup called January 6th, and that's what that whole thing was about, certification day of the election. Once we do that in the country, that's that. There is no means of hitting rewind and going back. That's why the certification is so important. So, here we go again. He's not calling to usurp the Constitution, but is saying again, don't we have to fix this if we've established there was fraud? And my answer to him would be respectfully, sir, I don't think there's any mechanism to fix this. Respectfully, I understand you're angry. I understand you believe you should rightly be the president for a second term. I think that's probably very so. I think that's probably true. But we don't have a mechanism to correct the certification of the election. There is no... there's nothing written in a document that I see that, that shows us how that's done. So, look, this is going to be my life for the next 2 years, is trying to navigate this Rorschach test about Trump and how you feel about him. Some of you think he's the only guy that has a set and is willing to fight this, and some of you are so sick and tired of him, you want him gone. I get it. But I don't, I guess I'll say again, I don't want any of you listening to this show, people that come on it and say what they say about Trump, say what they say about Trump. I'm not trying to elicit reactions from them. I'm asking them about things that are in the news and that are out there. Their reaction to it, or if you hear a lack of reaction from me, or that I'm not pounding the table arguing with somebody, doesn't mean I endorse or argue a point someone's making. Everybody is free to have their opinion here about Trump, and I'm not in the business of defending or prosecuting Donald Trump. He's a big boy, and you're big people. You don't need me sitting here telling you, Lord knows, after all this time, nobody needs me telling them how to think or feel about Donald Trump. I'm trying to navigate it. That's all. That's all.
Here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Blixin' and blixin' and all his rain.
No, I've never gone. I've been invited, but I kind of always instinctively knew I didn't want to go. The Pennsylvania Society. No, Chris Brennan over at the Inquirer, who's a hardcore committed leftist and hates Republicans, was sent to the annual Republican event called the Pennsylvania Society. It's a big black tie, swanky deal in Manhattan. That never made sense to me. Ever since I moved to Pennsylvania and started covering Pennsylvania politics as a conservative, and they said that their annual Republican event, something called the Pennsylvania Society, was held in Manhattan. And I said, well, that seems like a red flag to me right away. Why in the world would the who's who of Pennsylvania Republican politics go to New York City? That just felt filthy. Honest to God, I'd been invited the first couple of years I lived here, and I didn't want to go. It felt like do you know what I thought? And I'm serious. I thought, oh, that sounds like the fastest way I could be corrupted.
Oh, good thought. Yeah.
Really, honestly. And I just said no. So I rebuffed the invitation. I thanked, politely declined. I've never been. But it's a big who's who of backslapping where everybody, pretends to be friends. And Chris Brennan writes this, and it's interesting. And for you Pennsylvania Republicans, I'd love to get your take on this. A swift and sudden shift is underway by the Keystone State's Republican Party approach to mail-in ballots. Sounds like a lot of people attending the Pennsylvania Society have been listening to the show. No surprise. After two solid years of Republicans' negative rhetoric about the alleged dangers of mail-in balloting, party leaders are looking at Pennsylvania's results in 2020 and 2022. Democrats vastly outnumbering Republicans in using mail-in ballots and had two very good election years to show for it. Now, let me just first say, I am not thrilled about being pro-mail-in ballot. I don't want anybody to confuse this. Accepting that mail-in ballots are a thing is different than being pro-mail-in ballot. I know maybe it's a difference without a distinction at this point. I am saying ballot collection must be the way forward because there's no way to fix it now. So we now have to play the game. These are the cards we've been dealt, sorry to say, by the Republican legislature. It will not be changed. Josh Shapiro is going to be governor of Pennsylvania for the next 8 years. He will never allow the change to be made. The Pennsylvania Republican Party does not have the ranks to change it or overturn this on their own without the governor's help. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, as it's currently constituted, won't allow it. So we're locked. We're absolutely landlocked. There is no, and this, there's some of you in this audience that still have not gotten your heads wrapped around this yet. So let me say it again. There's no changing this. Stop saying that! Well, I know you don't like that that's true, but it's true. There's no changing it. Mail-in ballots are here to stay. We will be collecting votes from people almost 2 full months before Election Day. That is what's going to happen. It's the new way forward, and no amount of screaming, you don't like it, and it's rife with fraud and problems. I agree with everything you feel about it. I do, too. I feel exactly the same way. And having said all that, we have to do it anyway. I hate it. I'm sorry. I hate the system, and I have to acknowledge it's here to stay, and we're going to have to learn to use it. It's just like, you know, when I went to rent a car the last time and they tried to push a Tesla on me. I was like, I don't want a Tesla. I just want to just give me a regular car. And soon I recognized that someday, probably in the not too distant future, they're going to force me to drive a Tesla. And I'm going to say, give me a regular car. And they're going to say, nope, we don't do regular cars anymore. We do only plug-in coal-fired cars. And I say, all right, damn it. I need a car to get from the airport to where I'm going. Give me the plug-in car then. And I'm going to grudgingly drive the car. That's what happens. So here we are, okay? I don't like it, but here we are. And so I just don't want people like Chris Brennan thinking, oh, I see, so you've had some big spiritual conversion. You got your butt kicked for 2 election cycles, and now all of a sudden you embrace mail-in ballot. No, mail-in ballots kicked our butts, and there were a lot of people that were recalcitrant and unwilling to go out and collect ballots ahead of the election. And yes, butts got kicked, so now we got to play that game. I don't like it, but we have to. So, at the Pennsylvania Society, the Republican chair in Pennsylvania, Lawrence Tabus, says, quote, we have to now recognize it's a legal means of voting in our state. We cannot allow the mail-in ballot to be ignored. I'm going to make great efforts to get our voters to vote by mail. Okay. I don't know this guy. Never interviewed him. Have no sense of if he's any good or not. You know, you have to conclude after this last election cycle, he's not. It's like Ronna Romney McDaniel running again for party chair. A lot of people think, after a couple of election cycles of getting our butts kicked, you probably shouldn't get a third term. Our friend Harmeet Dillon doesn't think so. So I don't know why it should be any different in Pennsylvania. Why should this guy get another term? In fact, let's listen to this. Harmeet announced her intention to challenge Ronna Romney McDaniel to lead the Republican Party. She made the announcement official yesterday on Tucker.
Well, Tucker, I'm going to announce tonight that actually I am going to run for RNC chair. And the reason is that, you know, to play off of a famous catchphrase, Republicans are tired of losing. And I think that we really need to radically reshape our leadership in order to win. And we can't keep running elections like we did in the 90s and the 2000s. And we really have to modernize to compete with the Democrats dollar for dollar in the ways they fundraise, the way they deliver their ballots to the ballot boxes. Our messaging needs to be fresh and positive and not just reactive to news cycles and what the Democrats are doing. And I think that the party needs to realize that the party has become a populist party. The base of the party demands populist messages that speak to them and not Chamber of Commerce messages, not neocon messages, not warmonger messages. And I'm afraid that the base of our party is not getting what it needs from our leadership. And so after 3 successive rounds of really disappointing results, Tucker, I'm a member of the RNC and no other member is stepping up to challenge leadership. And our current leadership has never been challenged for the chair job. And I think that challenge and competition is very good. And so I'm hoping to gain the support of grassroots Americans who do not like the direction of the party and its leadership. They need to contact the 168 members of the RNC in their states and territories and tell them that they too want change. And I think that change is popular among the base. I hear from thousands of Americans on a weekly basis about that. They want to see us fighting. Tucker, you know as well as anybody else that I'm a fighter.
Yes, and I you
fight
are.
Every waking hour of the day. And that's what we need right now. And so that's me. I'm offering to take a giant step back from my law firm and my nonprofit to do this. Yeah. It's a big sacrifice. But I think it's important for our country that I love so much as a first generation immigrant.
Okay.
I love it. I can.
So that's our friend Harmeet Dillon, chair of the Republican Lawyers Association. She's going to challenge Ronna Romney McDaniel. In Pennsylvania, apparently the same guy is going to stay in place, and nobody's going to do a damn thing about it. I mean, that's what I read from this story. Andy Riley, Republican National Committee member from Delaware County, said the party is bigger than any one candidate, even Trump. Mail-in ballots are the way to go, he said, and to get there, the party's going to have to look past typical political consultants and may hire professional advertising firms to shift the message going forward. Okay. There have been rumblings about whether this guy, Tabas, I don't know him. Honestly, I'm not playing dumb. I really don't know who he is. Maybe we should have him on the show. That he could last his full term until 2025. Rob Gleason, who was the party chair when Trump won Pennsylvania in 2016, no thanks to Rob Gleason, but anyway, said Republicans need to do a lot of soul searching right now. We need to recover quickly and not let another cycle go by without taking a beating, or with taking a beating. Gleason, who's an ally of the current guy, Tabas, said the party misstepped this year by not endorsing candidates for governor and Senate, leading to crowded primaries won by Mastriano and Oz. At the Pennsylvania Society, party establishment wonders what could have been, especially because Democrat success at the top of the ticket probably helped that party take control of the House, the State House. We should never have endorsed the candidates we had for Senate and governor, Gleason said, and I think people learned a lesson from that. Endorsements are very important. We should never have had the candidates we had for Senate and governor. I'm sorry, not endorsed. He said, we should never have had the candidates we had for Senate and governor. So again, their summary is that we lost this election because of the candidate quality. Now, here's the thing. I'm increasingly intrigued in this candidate quality analysis. Were Dr. Oz and Doug Mastriano the same kind of guy?
No,
not even close. They couldn't have been light years different, more different. And both of them lost. And you can point to various reasons both of them lost. Everybody wants to make it about Trump. Trump is the only unifying force between Oz and Mastriano. That's it. Only because his name was on both. And he came to Doug late. Doug Mastriano ran and won on his own with the base, and he won decisively and heartily early with the base of this party. And then what happened? When the base of the party spoke, what did so many people at the Pennsylvania Society and the Rob Gleasons and the Lawrence Tabases of the world do? What did they do? They turned their nose up and said, we can't win with this white supremacist. In fact, I have a story I've been sitting on the last couple of days. The teams helping Josh Shapiro prepare to become Pennsylvania's next governor include wealthy Republican donors. This is from the Inquirer a couple of days ago. Governor-elect Josh Shapiro is preparing for his inauguration and making key decisions about his administration, surrounded by some of the well-heeled donors who helped make his campaign the richest in Pennsylvania history. Chairing the Transition Leadership Board is Bill Sasso, a longtime GOP power player who helped former Republican Governor Tom Corbett's transition team. Jim Schultz, former counsel for Corbett and Trump, is also the transition personnel team for the lieutenant governor-elect. The announced team also includes current and former executives from Independence Blue Cross, several major law firms, Comcast, and the Giant Eagle supermarket chain. So this is now a who's who of wealthy, connected political figures, part of the closest inner circle of the Shapiro transition team. And there are a bunch of people ticked off about it now on the left that are mad that Shapiro is a traditional politician surrounded by a bunch of well-heeled, moneyed, uber-connected, uber-wealthy corner office C-suite types who have no allegiance to political moorings and just seem to be nothing but a bunch of party insiders and corporate class types. The Republican Party, as constituted, as organized in Pennsylvania, not the voters, not the base of voters, but the people who run the Republican Party in Pennsylvania decided they didn't like you chose Doug Mastriano. And as such, they threw their support and their weight and their time behind. I mean, hell, even Broad and Liberty was writing. Broad and Liberty, which is a publication that we promoted here often. Broad and Liberty was writing gushing, glowing pieces about Josh Shapiro because they'd made up their mind that Doug Mastriano was too extreme. So, I'm sorry. Look, can I hear criticisms of Doug Mastriano? Of course I can. But the fix was in for Shapiro long ago. The Republican Party establishment and the elites in the Republican Party and the power brokers in the Republican Party of Pennsylvania decided Josh Shapiro was going to be the next governor. And they're now actively licking his boots and, you know, sitting around sniffing his throne, trying to touch his cape as he ascends to the governor's seat. They all want a piece of the action. They knew he was going to win. No media scrutiny of Josh Shapiro. It is just so dishonest to review the 2020 election or the 2022 election and say, oh, it was Trump. The fix was in by the party for Josh Shapiro from the jump, by the Republican Party. It just was. The Republican Party mounted no meaningful effort whatsoever against Josh Shapiro. And they know it. And if I had this party chair here, I'd say it to his face. And yet they have the balls when it's all said and done to blame the candidate. Candidate quality's fault. We should have endorsed early. We should have gotten involved. We should never have had the candidates we had. We stayed out of it, and the base picked who they wanted, and look at the mess they made. Now, see, it's just the opposite. It's not supposed to be that way. When your voters, if you stay out of it and your voters make a decision, then you say, the voters have spoken, now we go headlong for their candidate and help. That's not what they did. We're embarrassed of our voters. We at the Pennsylvania Society don't like Doug Mastriano. You got to be stopped. By the way, Rob Gleason is predicting this current chair will serve out his full term. And the current chair agrees. There's no movement, no effort whatsoever to oust me. There's no story there at all. Every election, things go, people talk about change. Ain't nothing happening to me. I'm rock solid. I'm not going anywhere. Not my fault. Okay. Ronna Romney McDaniel at the National Party feels the same way, I'm sure. Ain't nothing going to happen to me. Not my fault. It's Trump. It's you stupid voters who keep picking people like Mastriano. Okay, we'll see. Mark tweeted at me today. He's exactly right. He said, Chris, this is the first gubernatorial election in Pennsylvania with no debate of any kind. There was no debate. You're exactly right. We screamed and screamed about this. And do you remember the current chair, Lawrence Tabas or Tabas, whoever the hell he is? I don't even know. How sad is it that I don't even know how to pronounce the Pennsylvania Republican Party chairman's name? You'd think that's a name I should know. You'd think that's a guy that would want to come on a show like mine. You'd think he'd reach out. Never heard of him. Couldn't pronounce him. Couldn't pick him of a lineup. No idea who he is. Wouldn't you think? Did you ever hear? And I'm serious. Honest question. You can tell me the truth. Did you ever hear from Lawrence Tabas? Did you ever hear anything about him during the entire run of the 2022 midterms, Fast Eddie?
No, I didn't hear from him. I didn't hear from the local party in any way. The national, yes. Local, no.
Did you hear about? Did you know who he is?
No.
Have you ever met him? Have you ever heard from the office, from the desk of? Any emails?
Honestly, no.
Did you ever read one story about the Pennsylvania Republican Party chairman objecting to the fact that we didn't have debates?
Nope.
Did you read one story about the Pennsylvania Republican Party chairman objecting to a vegetable refusing to debate Dr. Oz?
Never.
Yeah, me either. Candidate quality. That was the problem. And now they show up at the Pennsylvania Society in their black tie, drinking their Manhattans and talking about, yes, I think we'll start collecting mail-in ballots. But the candidate quality has to improve, don't you think, Muffy?
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. WNTP Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
You are a role model for the rest of the media. You really do investigative reporting and informative interviews.
Absolutely love your show.
Chris, greetings from the bright lights of Cherry Hill.
Space is exciting. It spurs our imaginations, and it forces us to ask big questions. Space, it affects us all, and it connects us all.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
You know, if you've been a regular listener of this show for a while, that my wife and I have been exploring in a separate podcast with something called the Herzog Foundation, a foundation committed to developing and encouraging and fostering, helping people grow private Christian education out there. You know that the one constant theme that I've had on this show for me, my wife, and our family, as well as I encourage so many of you that are unhappy with your current public education system to explore. There's just too much out there right now available to you, whether it's parochial, whether it's private, whether it's Christian, whether it's homeschool, homeschool pods, whatever. I just hope that you will explore it because there's a lot of options is my point. So I hope you'll check that out. But Dr. Vermeil Green is with us, a former school teacher herself, administrator for 45 years. She's authored a book called Please Teach Me Like I'm a Boy, 10 Steps to His Success in School and in Life. And there are a couple of different reasons to have Dr. Green on the show today, and I welcome you in because there's some news I wanted to discuss with you too, Doctor, but thanks a lot for your time today. Hi.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Let me speak generally before we get into some of the news of the day and one of the things I wanted to ask you about. You were in education for a long time, or still are, I guess, to a degree, so talk to me about where you see the state of education today.
I'm concerned, and I'm concerned because I see districts moving away from teaching the fundamentals. You know, it may be old-fashioned to say it, but reading, writing, and arithmetic is what has made this country and its workforce strong for decades. Unfortunately, with a new ideology and political agendas infiltrating the schools, starting at the teachers' unions, and then coming into the schools, I think it's really diluting the purpose of education. And that is, first of all, to raise a moral, educated society. Unfortunately, I am not very optimistic.
And do you, I guess I would say this, I don't know how many people you still communicate with in the field today. I always like to say that I know a lot of really good people, sincerely good people who love to teach, and they got into teaching for all the right reasons. And now a lot of them feel trapped because quite frankly, there's a system built, you know, I know in multiple states where, you know, it's just undeniably true. I'm not knocking people for this. They have a pension system that's waiting on them on the other side of retirement. Maybe they're 10 years from it. But now maybe they're asked to do some things that really compromise the way they feel they should lead a classroom or just kind of their general character and their belief system. What would you say to them? I feel very sorry for them in many ways because it's sort of lose-lose.
You know, I feel the same way, Chris, because a lot of the decisions about what is being taught, it's taken out of their hands. The rank and file membership of the teachers unions, as you said, good people who got into the field because they wanted to help kids. They wanted to teach. They wanted to make school a great place to learn. But again, at the leadership level, they have an agenda that is almost antithetical to what the whole purpose of schools are, to educate and to raise good citizens. I think of the money. If I saw a recent article talking about the percent growth of population in public schools just in the last 20 years, and there's been like a 7.6% growth in students, an 8.7% growth in teachers, but a 87.6% growth in district administrators. I mean, there's something wrong with that. When you're spending all your money in administrators, and administrators are the ones who, unfortunately, are bringing in this new agenda.
Do you think it is it fixable? I mean, I've seen, for instance, I saw, I think just last week, the Wall Street Journal said one of the missed storylines in the midterm elections last month was that a lot of school boards, those who ran against these kind of radical left-wing agenda items, won school board races. A lot of them did. And a lot of people believe the school board fight is the place to have it. Some have said to me, though, Dr. Green, that, you know, the ship has sailed. While it's noble, it's kind of like charging hell with a water pistol. So I don't know where you see public education today. Can it be fixed? And are school boards the key, or do they need a more robust challenge from outside entities, like I mentioned, private education or faith-based education or homeschooling?
I think both. Because our children, we may put them in private schools, Christian schools, parochial schools, but they still have to grow up in a world with children who are educated in the public sphere, public school sphere. So for those school boards that are newly elected, I just pray that they are not taken in by the so-called experts who are feeding them information, that they ask the right questions, that they inform themselves and they educate themselves on some of the issues. I love the fact that our parents are choosing Christian schooling or homeschooling. For me, that is the best way to educate a child, especially in these times. But for those children who are in the public schools, those school boards need to continue to be the advocates for those children.
Dr. Green, your book, Please Teach Me Like I'm a Boy, 10 Steps to His Success in School and Life. Talk to me about that book and the concept. To some, I'm sure it's a provocative title. Please Teach Me Like I'm a Boy. What does that mean?
It wasn't meant to be provocative, but you're exactly right, Chris. Some people look at that and say, oh, my goodness. No. That is not. And oh, my goodness. You know, boys learn differently than girls. I don't care what kind of parts you cut off and parts you add or hormones you pump into them. Boys and girls are different. Now, I'm speaking in generalities now, but boys' brains, they just function differently than girls' brains. And they tend to have struggles or challenges with certain subjects. For example, boys, they really struggle, again, generally speaking, with language arts, reading and writing. Girls, on the other hand, they tend to struggle with computational math. But what happened is that girls had wonderful advocates who said, wait a minute, our girls aren't doing well at math. Let's put more language arts into math. So it was no longer 1 + 1 = 2. You had to explain in detail why 1 + 1 = 2. And even though your answer may not have been correct, you had a wonderful explanation. So we'll give you extra credit for that. So what happens is that the girls began to thrive in areas that they had fallen behind. And then that's fine. I want to help the little girls. I used to be a little girl. But you can also help the boys. This is not a zero-sum game. And boys need help when it comes to reading and writing, all those language arts, because, again, their brains learn differently. They can learn and they will learn. But teachers first have to realize that there are learning differences. They have to teach differently. They have to deliver the information differently. And our boys can thrive. Because if they don't thrive academically and they have to stay in that school, they unfortunately become behavior problems. So you look at this data across the country. Who's at the top of suspension and expulsion rates, but at the bottom of test scores? Our boys.
Yes, and I must tell you, having my wife and I have experienced this, we have two older sons who are about done with high school, and our daughter who's in middle school, we've removed and put in a private Christian school. The difference in the way they learned, we see it right away. Now, while it has challenged academically my daughter a little more, my sons, you can just see that as boys, I just believe this, I think you'd confirm it, It's a bit of a stacked deck against boys. Sometimes they're often we're often told they're hyperactive or they're too distracted or you know they get bored. And it's not that these boys are my boys or most boys are unintelligent or unwilling to learn. It's that there's kind of this systemic expectation of the way they're to learn. And I guess having gone through all this, my point in telling you is I'm more committed now to the idea than ever before that the one-size-fits-all top-down model of education was just a terrible mistake. It was not just bad for them. It was bad for me and bad for my parents. And I wish we could do it all over again, but here we are. That's what I think I'm learning.
and I believe that you are learning correctly. But at the root of it is that we have schools that are very girl-friendly. Because if you look at the teaching force, overwhelmingly female. And we women, we tend to teach the way that we learn, which is a lot of reading and writing and talking and the kinds of stories we like, fairy tales and butterflies, whatever. But with our boys, not so. But our boys need more hands-on, more problem solving. They need to be outside. They need to be moving. But as schools have moved more to this model of sit and get, versus, you know, be out and exploring, our boys have really suffered from that.
This is a fact. I can't wait to get my hands on your book. I'm sorry I didn't know about it before now. It was actually, it's been released since 2020, but I now that I'm familiar with it, I can't wait to read it. Please teach me like I'm a boy, 10 steps to his success in school and life. Dr. Vermeil Green, what an important bit of work. And do you teach today or no?
No, I don't teach today. I volunteer for a homeschool co-op. Up until COVID, I used to substitute teach in a local public schools just to keep my finger on the pulse of education. And, of course, doing reading and talking to people and looking at educational policy. But I really would urge people, especially those people with sons, to visit our website, theboysinitiative.org, where we have resources and articles that will enlighten parents, because parents have to become informed about what's happening in education, especially with their sons.
Dr. Green, thank you for your time. And I, if you don't mind, I would love to have you over to the podcast with my wife and myself. I think you would make a marvelous guest for a deeper dive in this subject. So I hope we can have you back.
All you have to do is call me. I'll be there, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you. The telephone number, 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Fascinating lady. Hey, Teresa in Newtown Square. Teresa was caller number 9. She won a fabulous teeth whitening from Dr. Spinato at Williamsburg Dental earlier in the hour. And I wanted to say thank you, Teresa, for listening. Thanks to all of you who've listened. I don't know if you're a Harumph Society member yet, but I will tell you this. I'll share with you a story that I put up on the Harumph Society yesterday. I could not put it. This is one of those stories that I wanted to tell. I'll tell it here because I know I'm safely out of earshot from the people involved. I would love to tell this story on social media, and I can't. Because there are too many people who know the people that I am talking about that my wife would be horrified. And in fact, when the thing happened over the weekend, she looked at me and she said, "You can't talk about this on the show." And I said, "But it's the most wonderful story that's happened to me in a long time, and I really need to tell it because it's a wonderful, funny story." "You can't." And I said, "Well, maybe if there are rules, what if I tell the story in the Harumph Society?" She said, "Okay, fine." And I said, "What if I tell it early? And I know I'm out of earshot of the principal players involved." She said, "Well, maybe." So if you're a Harumph Society member, you would have already seen it. Not only will you have gotten some fantastic analysis of the Twitter files, but you would have heard this story already. By the way, you also get a great discount code at the Stigall shop right now for some great Harumph Society gear. The Harumph Society mug is flying off the shelves, incidentally. It's a great-looking mug. I just ordered my own. It says the Harumph Society on one side of the mug. On the other side, it says I didn't get a Harumph out of that guy. Fantastic mug. Can't wait to get my own. But if you'd like to go to the Stigall Shop, you can go straight to StigallShop.com. But if you become a Harumph Society member, you'll get a promo code, which will give you a discount at the Stigall store. and get some Harumph gear. But you can get a 13-month subscription for the price of 12 months at the Harumph Society right now through Christmas Eve. And I've got a new Advent study, part 2 of 4, that's free to everybody at the Harumph Society coming out tomorrow. So I hope you will subscribe to the Harumph Society, whether you're a free subscriber or whether you're a monthly or an annual subscriber. Go to ChrisStegall.com, click on the Harumph Society, and subscribe today. So, okay, I'll tell you quickly, but I got to keep this between us and I got to move on quickly. I was only going to tell Harumphers, but this is just too good. I couldn't resist telling at least some of you. I'm at this Christmas party on Saturday, and I'm seated around. It's a very lovely setting, and I'm seated around a table of, I don't know, maybe 10 people. And there's a guy at the table whose last name I recognize. And somebody kind of brokers a conversation. I don't know him. I've never met him, but I recognize his last name when he was introduced to me. And somebody said, Chris, I think you know, let's call him Larry. I think you know Larry. Larry has a relative I think you went to high school with. And then I put the last name of Larry together with the guy I went to high school with. I go, oh, yes, yes. I'll call the guy I went to high school with Bob. I said, yeah, Bob. I went to high school with Bob Smith. This is Larry Smith sitting at the table, all right? We'll call him Larry Smith. I went to school with Bob Smith. And Larry says, yes, yes, yes. Bob's my nephew. And I said, oh, okay, yeah, great guy. Little older than me, and I was trying to quickly recall, you know how you do in polite conversation, trying to make any conversation. I said, I'm thinking back. I go, yeah, a little older than me. I go, as I remember, he was a wrestler. And Larry, sitting at the table, looks at me and gets stony-faced. Like I've just said something really objectionable. And he said, well, he starts to kind of stammer and pause. And he looks down and he says, well, it was an unfortunate period of time, but yes. And I, you know, as an attorney and his uncle, I represented him, but we got through. And I'm totally perplexed. I have no idea why he's responding to me this way. I said, oh, yeah, he was a wrestler. And he's like, oh, it was unfortunate. He seems really glum about the whole thing. The table's confused because everyone's listening. Everyone's quiet and listening to this conversation. His wife interrupts him and says, Larry, he said a wrestler, not arrested. Fast Eddie, I have never felt such uncomfortable silence and awkwardness in my life. The guy just coughed up out of the blue, apropos of nothing, that his nephew, the guy I knew from high school, had been arrested because he misheard me. And my mind starts racing immediately with, as he's saying, well, it was a bad period of time, and I, you know, as an attorney, I represented him, and I thought, what the hell is he talking about? His wife stops him. Like, this, here's what's amazing, is the guy kept kind of like, there are 1,000 things about this. Number one, he thought I said arrested. Now, imagine a total stranger saying something like that in polite conversation to make conversation. Oh, yeah, I know him. He was arrested. But then imagine hearing that and being forthcoming with it in conversation. Like, well, yes, okay, let me give you some of the details since you've asked. His wife saved him from going off the cliff on the description of the thing. The whole table is in a total awkward silence about the whole deal. Nobody knows what to do. I said, oh, no. I said, wrestler. And the guy said, oh, I thought that was a little forward for just having met.
I'm an injector of chaos. I would have been like, no. He totally said arrested. Please go on.
A wrestler. No, honey, he said a wrestler, not arrested. Well, I was his uncle, and I represented him as an attorney. Oh, man. May I also ask you something else? Same party. I got to ask you this. I got to get this off my chest. Folks, this is something I got to ask you, the smartest audience in all the radio. This bugs me. Same party. I don't, for the life of me, I don't understand this. And I mean you no disrespect. Fast Eddie and I talked about this after the show. And I wasn't going to bring this up, but I'm going to now. I don't mean any disrespect. It's kind to be invited, but there's something that bugged me. We get to the party, and on the front door, taped to the door, is a note. Before we walk in, you're supposed to let yourself in. And the note says, "Thank you for removing your shoes before entering." It's a great way of saying, take off your shoes before you come in without asking you, but declaring it and sounding nice about it. Thank you in advance for removing your shoes. Now, I have to ask you, and I mean this with all the sincerity in my heart. If you're hosting a party of people coming into your home, is there an element of expectation that something might get spilled or tracked in or broken? Do you have to kind of assume that, Fast Eddie, when you invite people into your home for a party? Don't you kind of have to assume it?
You know something's coming.
Something. Someone's going to knock something over. Someone's going to spill some wine. Someone's going to scuff the floor. Someone might track something in. That happens when you invite dozens of people into your home, doesn't it?
If you entertain, something's going down. Yep.
Can you invite bunches of people into your home and expect them all to act like they're fifth graders? You know, take your shoes, hands off the walls. Like, you know what I'd just say to you? I respect that you have a lovely property, and I respect you don't want anything broken or tracked in or whatever. Maybe just don't host the party at the house. Maybe get a private space somewhere at a restaurant, or don't host at all. Like, why should I disrobe like it's TSA to come to your Christmas party? Am I being unreasonable here?
It wasn't raining, right?
There was no inclement weather, no bad weather. Right. I have to ask because this is just something I need to know as a custom. Taking off the shoes. Now, you may do it as a courtesy if you've walked through rain or mud or snow or whatever to walk into someone's home. I totally respect if you've decided independently, I'm going to remove my shoes as to not track in. Do you ask your guests you've invited to your home for your party to remove their shoes? And if you do, I need to speak with you about it. I'm not going to fight with you, but I do need to talk with you about a few things. Or if you find that completely objectionable, 610-850-0990, the number. I need to get some party etiquette settled right now. My wife and I have had a lengthy discussion about this. She forbade me from bringing it up, but I can't resist. Because it's just been driving me nuts. Asking guests to remove their shoes coming into the Christmas party. I mean, what? Look, if you have a property that's that nice, that you want to protect, I assume you got a couple of bucks. Are you telling me there's anything on my shoes or anything I could do wearing shoes in your home that you can't afford to fix? Like, worst case it.
Well, it's Christmas time, pretty baby, and the snow is falling on the ground.
I didn't say they were bad people. Christine's texting me, freaking out. You can't tell the shoe story. I'm not making a judgment. I'm asking a question. We were invited to a Christmas party this weekend, and we show up, and at the front door, it's a lovely home, lovely property, and on the door is taped a note. Come on in. Thank you for removing your shoes. Can I be honest with you? I saw that note, and I thought about turning around, getting back in my truck, and leaving.
You didn't know you were going to a party with felons, man.
I thought about leaving. It irritated me. It just irritated me. I don't want to get undressed to walk into someone's home for a party. I'm not interested in it. Had you told me one of the requirements to come into the party would be de-shoeing, I probably would have thought twice about going. And it's not that I think you're a bad person. I don't. It's your house. You can make any demand. If you want everybody to show up in scrubs, you can order it. That's fine. I respect it. But let me know in advance. Don't spring it on me when I've shown up. Christine said, they can do as they please. They're nice people. I said, of course, I'm not stipulated. They're nice people, and yes, they can do as they please. I'm just saying that if I invited people to my home, no matter how nice, no matter how fancy, no matter how much money I've invested in the thing, if I'm inviting people in to party at it, I'm going to let them do what they want within reason. Now, I'm not going to, you know, they can't bring in blowtorches and fire off guns, but I, you know, within reason, I'm not... do you mind removing your clothes? Well, no, I do mind. So I have to settle this once and for all. 610-850-0998. My wife thinks these people are well within their right and there's nothing wrong with it at all. And I, for one, say, listen, they're well within their right, but let me know in advance. I don't know why it bugs me. It's your right, but it bugs me. So Fran starts this in Flower Town. What do you say, Fran? Let's put this to bed once and for all. Settle it for me. Good morning.
Well, I might have a little bit of a different take. I'm a realtor, so in our line of work, we have to either provide booties or ask people to, you know, take their shoes off. But we're
makes
trying to
sense.
Sell the product, right?
Yes, because those are strangers trouncing through a house. That makes perfect sense.
Okay, but my thing is you can't go to a restaurant without shoes on. You know that whole motto of no shoes, no shirt, no service? You know, like, I think it's gross. I mean, I don't know about you, but you have your Oxford shoes and you've been in work all day and you go to a party, you take your shoes off. I'm thinking you might need a little talc or something, you know?
Here's the other thing, Fran. Well, this point, somebody said to me, well, Chris, you know, shoes carry in a lot of bacteria and other things and blah, blah, blah. And I go, listen, Howard Hughes, if you're that weird about germs and bacteria and stuff being tracked in your house, again, I ask, why are you hosting a party?
Well, I agree with you. And I would just, I mean, I guess you did take your shoes off. Is that right?
I ended up, the thing is, it wasn't just shoes, they're boots. I was wearing boots, which it's not okay. Like, you know, I mean, I got to take these damn, you got to sit down and wedge yourself out of the thing. Boots don't just slip off like they're tennis shoes either, you know?
Right, you're not putting bread bags on to get your boots back on. But the thing is this, you know, the topic of conversation had to be quite different at that point. I mean, there had to be a lot of people uncomfortable with, I don't know, maybe I'd use the term smelly feet. I don't know. But the thing is that would be, I don't know, I would at a party, I would think, you know, pay for extra cleaners or do something like that. But if you're going to have a bash, you can't do that. You really can't.
Well, look, there are people that have that issue with foot odor problems, and that would be another question I'd have. You show up at a party like that not expecting to have to take your shoes off and you've got that issue, that could be an indelicate situation for somebody else, I would think, right?
Certainly, if you're there with your spouse, I'm sure she's maybe, you know, I don't know. I don't know what your feet are like, but, you know.
Mine are fantastic, by the way. Odor-free and flawless.
A drug store nearby that might help you out with a little Lysol or something. But I mean,
and in
you know,
fact,
they should provide that.
Here's what's very funny, Fran. This is also a true story. It just so happened I put on a brand new pair of socks that I had never worn before. That night, just totally coincidentally. So I was well prepared, but irked nonetheless.
Okay. Well, I think if you ask something, you know, of the people, they should either provide you with booties or Lysol or whatever to kind of make you feel comfortable with that situation. Sort of.
That's a good point.
Amenities as you show up to the.
I like that shoe amenity, foot amenities. Thank you, Fran. Thanks, Fran. You hire like a team of people to do like pedicures at the door. You know, like a little ped spa off to the side. Kathy in Warrington next. Hey, Kathy, what do you say? Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Chris. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I hope you'll settle this for me once and for all. Do you make your guests take off their shoes?
They should not take off their shoes. I totally agree with you. And it reminds me of an episode of Sex and the City, where Carrie was in the same predicament. She goes to a birthday party and the requirement, and I don't know if you remember that show, but she wore very expensive Jimmy Choo high heels.
Yeah.
So she takes her shoes
I wasn't
off.
Wearing those.
No, I like the boots, but still, you know, shoes make the outfit, right?
That's right. Well, and I have heard, here's somebody did text me and they said, Stigall, high heels do terrible damage to wood floors. Now, this person had commented that they had just installed brand new wood floors. And I think to myself, here again, all due respect, if that's what it's about, why are you hosting a party?
Exactly. And I totally agree with you. Well, she ended up, I don't know if she sued the woman. I forget what she did, but she actually got the pair of shoes back. Like the woman went and bought $450 shoes. They either got stolen or ruined at the party because they were very expensive shoes. And one other quick story, my sister-in-law was the same way. Like you couldn't walk into her house. It was a known thing in my family, take off your shoes. So when my in-laws would come to my house, my mother-in-law would start to take her shoes off. I said, Mom, you don't have to take your shoes off. I'm not your daughter.
Yeah, I just don't. Like, what are people doing out there that you have to de-shoe? Like, what? I get it if you're talking about toddlers who've just come in from the mud. But, like, what are grown adults being asked to take off the shoes coming into relatives' home? Hey, take off your shoe. What the hell? Where do you think I've been? Like, I walked from my car across your sidewalk. What's the matter with you?
I totally agree. Not have hosted the party. And I just want to say, Chris, I discovered you through my tax accountant 3 years ago, and you have no. All good.
Okay, good. I thought I was being audited.
No. He recommended your station, and you have kept me sane through COVID. I don't even watch mainstream news anymore. If it wasn't for you, I'd be insane. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Kathy. Merry Christmas. Thank you so much for listening. That's kind. I hope you'll stay in touch. 610-850-0990, the number. In Delaware County, it's Paul. Hey, Paul, I hear you're pro removal of shoe, which is fine. I invited you to the show. Welcome in.
Okay. If you've ever been to Japan, 130 million people take their shoes off every day before they enter their homes. In New York, if you go to an ashram, you take off your shoes. And some people are embarrassed because they have holes in their socks, whatever. But it's a mores. And in the Middle East, if you show the sole of your shoe when you cross your leg, or it's an insult because you wouldn't eat off the bottom of your shoe. That's the criteria because you are bringing dirt into the house, and they believe that's what happened. So,
well, I appreciate all those things. These people are neither Muslim nor Japanese.
No, it doesn't make any difference. They probably got exposed to that somewhere with the Japanese people or been to Japan or whatever. But it's just respect. And I've been to many homes where they say, take your shoes off. Fine. I take them off. Fine. Sometimes I'll just normally do it anyway. You know,
if it's just I don't fault you if that's what you choose to do. I think it's but to ask everyone to do it, to invite. Now, see, the thing is, though, here's the missing component. It's one thing if people, you know, I'm knocking on your door and I drop in on you and they say, hey, do you mind slipping off the shoes? It's another thing to host an organized party. Hear ye, I want 100 people to come to my lovely home, but first, before you do so, remove your shoes. I feel like that's a different set of circumstances. True or false?
That's true. But if you haven't been exposed to those mores, you don't think it's you should do it. But if you've been to Japan or if you've been to India, you take off your shoes. It's just respect.
All right.
These people may have been exposed to that somehow. But I agree with you. That would be nice to do that. But you just have to go along with it because they requested it.
No, I know. I'm not going to argue with them about it. But it was almost a deal breaker. Paul, thank you. 610-850-0990. I don't know. To me, If you're announcing, I need you all to undress before you come into the house, it just says to me, you think the house is so damned important, everybody's got to tiptoe around it. So now I'm on edge, because now I'm thinking, oh, okay, now what am I going to break? What am I going to spill? What am I going to disrupt? What am I going to... Now I feel like I'm maybe in a museum. Museums don't ask you to take off their shoes. You know, it's like, look, I am just as much as anybody else. I like to keep a nice house. I like a well-appointed house. You know, I get all that. But my wife said to me, I was telling Fast Eddie about this year, like for years, I was someone who thought much, you know, my wife and I, when we were young, before we had kids, and then right as we had new kids, we were people that still thought you could have nice things and keep a house clean. And then you have kids and you realize, well, kids destroy everything. And they take crayon and they cut things up and they shred things and they yank things out of the wall. And then you realize for about 18 years, you can't keep a nice home because kids are just destructive. And so you kind of stop decorating. You stop, you know, going over the top and buying new furniture, painting. You know, you keep things picked up within reason, but that's it. And I think it was Christine, I give her credit, who said to me once, she said, you know, at some point you've just got to have a house that's lived in that people are comfortable in. And that made a lot of sense. I'd never thought much about it before, but would you rather your house look beautiful and immaculate and well-appointed, or would you rather your house be comfortable to people when they're in it? And that's a great point. And I would submit to you that when you invite people over and you say, everyone take off their shoes, you have instantly put everyone on defense. I think that's a message of discomfort. I don't think it's a message of comfort at all. 610-850-0990 as we go to Bill in Florida. Bill, what do you say about it? Good morning.
Mega harumphs. Chris, how are you?
Harumph, my friend. Glad to have you here. Thanks for listening.
Holding the central time zone half of this program down, but I broke my neighbor of either inviting me to a party or having people take shoes off because I ended up in the pool after a few old fashions with nothing else on but my socks, and I got yelled at. And I said, well, I've never jumped in a pool with my shoes on before. I felt like jumping in the pool because I didn't have my shoes on. I'm never going back to that house, or we're leaving our shoes on.
Yeah, that's it, Bill. Thank you. Listen, I think if you're going to do that, I appreciate the call. You have to. If there are rules to attending your home, I'm going to make the final decision on this. You ready? If there are rules to come to your home, stipulate them in the invitation. Do not surprise people with rules as they enter your home. Don't surprise people with the rules. If there are rules, let people know in advance. That's all. And then people can make an educated decision whether or not they attend your function. Don't spring rules. Come on in. Make yourself uncomfortable. Don't do that. Give me the option. Tell me up front. That's all. Not making a value judgment. It's your home. You can make any rules you want. Just let me know of them in advance. That's all I ask. I'm sorry. My wife's just seething at me that I even brought this up. But I had to address it. From me to you, and this is the smartest audience in all the radio. There's not going to be an issue with you. Don't invite people to your home and ask them to disrobe. Just let people know in advance, hey, I'm going to have a party, and when you come, I need you to take a few items off. If that's not something you like doing, then, consider skipping my party. That's better than inviting people to the party and then telling them to disrobe. Because then at that point, it's like, well, I have no choice. What do I do? Turn around and go home? I'd like to, but now I'm here. So now I've got to awkwardly stand around undressed. 610-850-0990. All right, we've addressed it. Okay, now I feel better. Somebody just sent me Sebastian Maniscalco. Apparently he does a riff on this in one of his stand-ups. Can't play it because it's full of expletives. But he says, do not ask grown people to remove their shoes. Don't do it. But I have white carpet. Why do you have white carpet? That's exactly right. Don't invite people into your museum if you don't want it destroyed. Build your temple, build your museum, and then don't ask anyone to come in it ever. How about that? Or if they do, just let them know. I've built myself a shrine that I don't want sullied by your human touch. So please, wrap yourself, disrobe, put on these gloves, and touch nothing. You can only look. All right. Wendy, congratulations. Caller number 9. She's an honorary Harumph Society member. We will make more of you honorary members throughout the holiday season. As it is Christmas, the Harumph Society is a great gift to give to your favorite conservative. I think those of you who are members, you already know. I really appreciate all your kind words about it. I'm very proud of it. I think it's a fantastic product myself. And I think quite a deal for 3 days a week, 144 editions at least. And actually on Saturday, we just proved we built out deep dive extra editions like we did on the Twitter files when news breaks. So I hope you'll check it out. Interesting story that's been filed now by two media outlets. This from NBC, our affiliate here. in Philadelphia on a convenience store in Broad and Allegheny. Gotten so bad out there, they've hired private security. Listen to some of this.
Heavily armed security guards now stand at this Carco gas station in North Philadelphia along Broad Street near Allegheny.
What do you got there?
This is an AR-15 shotgun.
Armed with long rifles and tactical gear, the owner of the gas station hired a security after mounting problems in and around the store.
Lately, we are completely tired from this all nuisance. Stealing, robbery, ATM missing.
Neil Patel is the gas station manager who showed us what vandals even did to his own car.
3 weeks ago, they cut my tire. I fixed that. Then they broke my bumper. I fixed that. I fixed that. Next day, did this.
Vandals breaking his windshield in the store, bags of food thrown on the floor. He says people selling drugs on the property are a constant threat and many times calls.
So that's how bad it's gotten. Private security with ARs patrolling the place. And all the customers say, I love it. We need more. I'm sure Governor Shapiro will fix it.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
I am a devoted listener every day, 3 hours, kids in the car, the whole thing.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Always love your show.
I just love your show. Just love it.
And so science matters. And all Dale's been saying to Governor Wolf is listen to the scientists.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
She was at the tip of the spear on the Hunter Biden laptop story. Nobody covered it more extensively and thoroughly, to the extent that it famously got thrown off Twitter. And her book, Laptop from Hell, Hunter Biden, Big Tech, and the Dirty Secrets the President Tried to Hide. I tell you, this event over the weekend, Miranda, with Elon Musk. Miranda Devine, welcome back. This basically, this revisits your book. I hope it sells a lot more copies and totally vindicates you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. Look, it's terrific that Elon Musk is showing a commitment to truth. He says he wants to make Twitter the platform where the truth is told. Let's see whether the truth is told there and the whole truth. It's a good start. The Twitter files that he dumped on Friday night via journalist Matt Taibbi, but he left out a crucial part of it, and that, of course, is the FBI involvement in really misleading Twitter, and we believe Facebook as well, into sort of pre-bunking or pre-warning them about our story that the FBI knew was real because they had the laptop. They'd had it for almost a year. And they also were spying on Rudy Giuliani, so likely had seen the emails from the computer repair shop guy who had given the laptop to the FBI, and they knew that he'd contacted Rudy Giuliani. And they also had access to messages between me and Rudy Giuliani, so they would have been aware that the Post was working on the story and roughly when we were going to publish. So we know from a senior executive at Twitter that the FBI was having weekly meetings with them before the 2020 election, and during those meetings warned Twitter to expect a hack and leak operation by what they call state actors, but really Russians. And they said it was likely to happen in October and likely to involve Hunter Biden. And, of course, our Hunter Biden laptop story was published on October 14, 2020, just exactly as the FBI had warned. And so it was obvious to Twitter and Facebook that this must have been the story that the FBI was warning them about. And that's why Twitter, it always surprised me. I couldn't understand why Twitter banned us and censored us and locked our account for 2 weeks based on a supposed violation of their, quote, hacked materials policy. Since nothing about the material we published was hacked, the laptop wasn't hacked. And so it was very surprising. But obviously Twitter was acting on the pre-bunking that they had from the FBI, which talked about a hack and leak operation by the Russians.
Miranda, I'm glad you bring up the FBI because I spoke at length about this yesterday. The thing that stuck out in my mind when I started hearing some people, I guess, sort of criticizing or arguing or nibbling around the edges of whether or not this was a violation of the First Amendment, they said, well, Elon hasn't really produced anything that says this was anything other than a campaign lobbying effort to keep bad information off of Twitter. But I was reminded right away, and I played it a lot, the clip of Mark Zuckerberg talking to Joe Rogan. He very definitively, clearly, some time ago, kind of inexplicably, to be honest, was so candid with Joe Rogan and millions of his listeners that, yes, the FBI came and specifically asked them and even said specifically, we handled it differently than Twitter did. So it kind of underscores what Elon has done, what you're saying, well before, you know, we had this conversation. It was out there for a while now, hasn't it been?
Yes, well, that conversation between Mark Zuckerberg and Joe Rogan was in August, and it really coincided with some of the legal action that's been brought by the attorneys general of Missouri and Louisiana against the Biden administration for basically colluding with big tech to censor the dissenting views of Americans. And so it is through that lawsuit, which is incredible. It covers everything from suppression of, criticism of the Biden administration about their botched withdrawal from Afghanistan, about the lockdowns, about the vaccines, you name it. Anything that was detrimental to the Biden administration seemed to get censored by big tech. And so this very important lawsuit, which is bubbling along in the background, is what gave me some of the information that I published today about the FBI involvement in burying and suppressing our story about Hunter Biden's laptop. And so I feel like Zuckerberg was trying to get out ahead of what he knew was coming, because yes, Facebook is also being, various executives are being deposed, and they're having to appear before this lawsuit, along with, people like Jen Psaki and Elvis Chan, the FBI guy who organized those weekly meetings to make this false sort of debunking of our story, pre-bunking, sorry, I should call it. So I feel like Zuckerberg, because he almost deliberately, he'd already testified in January of 2021 October. Anyway, shortly after our story was censored, there was such outrage in Congress among Republicans that they hauled Zuckerberg and also Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, before congressional hearings, and which they did by Zoom, and sort of tried to tear strips off them and warn them that there'd be some sort of legislation to diminish their power. Zuckerberg in that did say something about this warnings from the FBI, but he went into greater detail with Joe Rogan, and it felt like he was almost kind of offloading blame onto the FBI and saying, look, the FBI is a legitimate organization, so if they come to you and they warn you about something, well, of course you're going to pay attention to them. So that just is very slippery, because it gets Facebook off the hook, just as Twitter off yes. the hook, because they're full of liberals, and they wanted Donald Trump to lose, and they wanted Joe Biden to win. So it was fertile ground that the FBI was plowing.
That's exactly my read on it. And it almost seemed, too, as though he was saying the way Twitter behaved was much more egregious than us.
Yeah.
It was like he was throwing Twitter under the bus a bit, I thought it sounded to me.
Yeah, me too. Exactly. And it's so egregious because Facebook was the first one out of the blocks to censor us that morning, October 14, 2020, within a few hours of our story going live. And in fact, it was a Facebook executive who used to work for the DNC who came onto Twitter and announced that Facebook was throttling our story in a tweet, which I found extraordinary.
Miranda, when you hear people say this is a violation of the First Amendment as you understand it, do you say yet that you're convinced that the First Amendment has been a law has been broken? Are these prosecutable crimes, or is this just fascist behavior, authoritarianism behavior?
No, 100%. It's a violation of the First Amendment, because the FBI is an arm of the federal government. They have no business interfering, and the federal government has no business instructing private companies to censor the views of American citizens. That is a clear violation of the First Amendment, and that is what this terrific lawsuit by Missouri and Louisiana is all about.
And then finally, Miranda, I just want to kind of underline this for people who don't use Twitter and aren't on it, because I think there is a tendency, and I've hammered this a lot, and I don't mean to bore people with it, but I think you can probably confirm this too. Twitter is a very significant, important thing to, or at least it was until Elon bought it. The American left and most mainstream media, it was their kind of their clearinghouse. It was their water, you know, their watering hole. It was where they all gathered and were given thumbs up or thumbs down on where stories progressed or died, is kind of the way I view Twitter. And so that's why I think even people who don't use it shouldn't view this as fringe or unimportant. Have I got that about right to media folks?
Yes, and there's another element of it, which is that, you know, all mainstream all news organizations, and I know for the New York Post, it cost us money and it cost us readers when we were censored and locked out of Twitter and Facebook. Those platforms, the social media platforms, are now crucial dissemination vehicles for news organizations. They really are the public square, even though they say that they're private organizations. They have commandeered, really, as a monopoly, they are globalist oligopolies, and they have commandeered the public square. They control the pipeline of information. So, and as you say, also, there's this added influence bit, which is involved with the fact that, you know, most journalists are on Twitter and get their information from Twitter. Stories break on Twitter before you see them sort of on websites. And so it's just a clearinghouse for information. It's more and more important in the news business.
What happens to it now? Final question for you, Miranda Devine at the New York Post. What happens to it now that it seems the American left is hell-bent on trying to discredit it, discredit Elon Musk? Now they make it sound like it's a dwelling for, you know, white nationalists and neo-Nazis and that sort of thing. Is it dead effectively to journalists today, do you think?
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. I mean, it's you know, from what Elon Musk is saying about his numbers, there's more engagement than ever, more users than ever. He also put out some data the other day saying there's less hate posts than ever, you know, hate, whatever that means.
Yeah. But
look, I think the problem with these social media platforms is that they are way too powerful. And the fact that Twitter and Facebook were able to censor and lock down stories from the country's oldest newspaper, the fourth largest by circulation, before an election, on a story that could have had an impact on the election. Even Elon Musk said that was election interference. That's outrageous. And, you know, within a few weeks, they also had deplatformed a sitting American president, the leader of the free world. And that sent shockwaves around the world. Even French President Emmanuel Macron was horrified, and he was no fan of Trump. He's a bit of a lefty himself, but he could see, as anybody can see, that it is not healthy for these, globalist oligopolies to have more power than the leader of the free world. So I think, regardless of whether Elon Musk is a good guy or a bad guy or has a commitment to truth or not, these platforms need to be broken up. They need to abide. You know, I don't know how the Republicans will do it. They have seemed reluctant to tackle Silicon Valley before, probably because they get so many of the donations from Silicon Valley. But the American people really need to insist that Republicans, when they get power back in the House in January and then later on, let's hope, in the Senate and the White House, that they break up big tech, just like the big railways were broken up. It is not healthy for our national discourse, for our democracy, for these companies to have so much power.
Miranda Devine, the book is called Laptop from Hell, Hunter Biden, Big Tech, and the Dirty Secrets the President Tried to Hide. Every word of it now completely validated. Not that it hadn't been prior, but now it certainly has been. And we're grateful for your excellent work and your friendship this year, Miranda. I don't know that we'll speak before the holidays, so I hope you have a very Merry Christmas.
Thank you so much, Chris. You too.
It's that time of year when the world falls in love. Every song you hear seems to say, Merry Christmas, may your New Year dreams come true.
And this Merry Christmas. Fascinating, and I were just talking, by the way, as we do every year, we will have a Christmas clearinghouse, a big giveaway over the next couple of weeks, starting next week and straight through Christmas. We have all kinds of gifts that we've amassed over the years that we want to, over the months, I guess I should say, over the last year, that we want to give to you. And so starting next week, I think almost every hour, I think every hour of every show for the next 2 weeks, we're like Oprah in here. Going to be able to give away a bunch of great stuff, some fantastic books and things, some Harump Society subscriptions I'm sure we're going to be giving away too. So stay close. Dave in Feasterville, congratulations. He was caller number 9. He's a brand new honorary Harump Society member, just like Wendy was earlier. Thanks for listening, Dave. I hope you enjoy it. And I do hope, sincerely, I'm awfully proud of this newsletter. I think you will find it of value too. This is not... you know, we're not just limping in there. It's not just slapping together a couple of sentences. This is some deep stuff that we work on. And I have a friend that assists me with a couple of news stories and links with regularity. So we kind of put together a full presentation. I write out some of my thoughts on things that I've been thinking. So we kind of present sort of a, if you want, like a monologue style, a reflection on some news headlines. Like I said, I throw a little spirituality in there every now and again. We've got the Advent series. The second week of Advent, that's free. I'm offering that up to everybody, whether you're a subscriber, paid or free. Everybody's going to get to hear the Advent series with the show Spiritual Advisor, week number 1 last week. Week number 2, which we're in right now, will come up tomorrow. So check it out, the Harumph Society. Also, the Stigall Shop. We've got great Harumph gear there. Go to chrisstigall.com. You'll see it all linked there. Michael Avenatti, poor fella. Sentenced to 14 years in prison on Monday for cheating 4 former clients out of millions of dollars and trying to obstruct the IRS from collecting payroll taxes from a coffee shop he owned. It caps off a stunning fall from grace for the former attorney, who is already serving 5 years in prison for stealing book proceeds from actress Stormy Daniels and trying to extort Nike out of $25 million. The beady-eyed little twerp. You knew he was no good. You knew he was just a rotten SOB, a bad, bad guy. You knew it. We knew it here. Every time he'd do an interview, we knew it. But that didn't stop the media from singing his praises. Here's just a montage of memory lane, how much they loved him.
Stormy Daniels lawyer Michael Avenatti is laying down the law. And is he really thinking about running for president?
Joining me now live, the man himself, Michael Avenatti.
Let's talk to somebody who understands the system very well. Michael Avenatti.
He's Donald Trump's worst nightmare. Michael Avenatti.
Michael, thanks so much for being here. Did you talk to Stormy Daniels last night? What was her reaction?
Did the president just get a new challenger for 2020? Stormy Daniels lawyer Michael Avenatti may have just tossed his hat into the ring.
Looking ahead to 2020, one reason why I'm taking you seriously as a contender is because of your presence on cable news.
First, let me take a moment to brag on my former student. This dude right here, I think of him as in a Justice League with Robert Mueller to save our democracy.
A 9-year-old boy has been reunited with his mother in Guatemala, and the person who helped make this happen, Stormy Daniels' lawyer and potential presidential candidate, Michael Avenatti.
What do you say to critics who say this is a publicity stunt?
Doing good work, having kids reunited with their parents. I mean, my record speaks for itself.
Probably one of the biggest stars we have at this dinner tonight. Of course, this is Michael Avenatti.
And the only person right here Donald Trump fears more than Robert Mueller.
Mueller.
Please welcome Michael Avenatti. I do think that that Trump is afraid of you.
Lawyers don't normally do talk shows.
I'm not your normal lawyer.
Yes, you are something of a folk hero now. Let's be honest, the whole reason that we're in love with you and Stormy is because we think you guys are the tip of the spear that's going to take down Donald Trump.
14 years in the federal pen. Michael Avenatti, we hardly knew ye. Telephone number 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Switzerland could ban electric vehicle use during their energy crisis from the I Kid You Not files. Switzerland could ban electric vehicles from being used in non-essential situations this winter. How far away do you think we are from being told our travel, our commuting is non-essential? Get everybody on the grid, get everybody plugging in their car, and then you will be deemed essential or non-essential in terms of your trips. The Telegraph reporting over the weekend, Swiss officials have drafted emergency proposals that restrict power usage if things get bad this winter. For example, shops may need to reduce their hours. Streaming services may need to be limited, and buildings may only be heated to 68 degrees. Other bans, according to the Telegraph, may include concerts, theater performances, sporting events, all to prevent a blackout. The reason Switzerland is preparing for possible blackouts is the country relies on imported energy. During the summer months, while more than half or 60% of the country's energy comes from hydropowered means, but in the winter months, production slows and the country relies on imports. The war in Ukraine has contributed to shortages in imports across all of Europe, but paired with Switzerland's dependency on hydropower, the country, as the Telegraph puts it, is vulnerable to energy shortages. So the country's emergency plan is split into two tiers, crisis and emergency. It also has three levels of restrictions in their first tier and two levels of restriction in the third tier. Swiss officials will activate each tier and level based on supply level. At the very minimum, buildings will only be able to be heated to 20 degrees Celsius. As things intensify, electric vehicles will be limited to essential trips. And worst-case scenario, concerts and sporting events will cease. Additional measures like escalators and holiday lights getting turned off, leaf blowers getting silenced, cryptocurrency mining getting banned are also included in the plan. Mining of cryptocurrency. How about everybody go into a digital currency and plug in cars? How about we do that, huh? No cash, no gas, no coal. Everything's electric. Boogie, oogie, oogie. Isn't that great? How great? Everything electric. Yeah, man, good for the environment. Until government officials say we don't have enough electricity, so we're going to need to power you down. Be forewarned, this is us. E.J. Antoni, one of our great economic thinkers on the show, has written a piece at foxnews.com, headline, November Jobs Report, Not a Blowout. It was a big disappointment, in fact, and he joins us again. E.J., glad you're here. Good morning.
Chris, good morning. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, you betcha. By the way, a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation as well. And EJ, before we get into those numbers in your piece, it's just obvious, it goes without saying, but let Switzerland, let most of Western Europe be a cautionary tale. You know, Germans are trying to build coal-fired plants as fast as they can. They have completely decapitated themselves. How humiliating. I wonder if European citizens know it. Like, you never hear it. I mean, we've seen protests in the streets, but wouldn't you love to hear some interviews and some polling how Western Europeans feel about being stuck, having to power down, you know, Christmas lights and keep their homes at a certain temperature, maybe not even be allowed to drive their electric vehicles because of the energy crisis?
Yes, and I'd love to know what those Germans think of their former leaders. Actually, some of them are still their leaders, who laughed at President Trump when he warned them against their over-reliance on Russian energy, and he begged them to diversify to American exports.
It's infuriating because it's all so obvious and self-inflicted. It's not like, oh gosh, we're shocked this happened. We're not shocked. How anyone could be shocked. But anyway, I digress. Not why you're here. So this jobs report, everybody was really doing backflips. The big headline was 263,000 jobs. Yahoo! So we're rolling, EJ and Tony. What's wrong with that?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it really is as if the people in the Biden administration, these so-called economists, don't even understand their own statistics. There was an enormous amount of double counting in the November report. In fact, there's been a lot of double counting of jobs for the last year. About a fifth of all the jobs we've seen added the last 12 months have been just that, double counting. And so these aren't actually more people employed. It's things like someone having to go out and get a second or even a third job. And when that happens, they're counted as an additional payroll. That's not necessarily someone better off. That's not necessarily a sign of the economy improving at all.
Yeah, so when people need to make ends meet and you decide to go get a second shift somewhere after your full day and you're waiting tables at night or something, you're counted as a new employee, even though you've already got one job.
Right, that's exactly right. And, you know, another really disturbing trend, since America, really the backbone of the American economy is small businesses, we've seen so many small businesses just get crushed by inflation, and they have a little less of a capacity to pass on some of those costs to their consumers compared to a big corporation, right? So what's happening is we're seeing small businesses close at an abnormally high rate, and people who previously were self-employed at their own small business, let's say, they're closing up shop and they're going to work for a big corporation. So again, there's not new jobs being created. A person has just shifted from one kind of employment to another. But because of the way these surveys are conducted, when I work for myself, in my own small business, I'm not counted in that payroll number. But when I go to work for a big corporation, I am. So once again, you're not actually employing more people. You've just goosed the non-farm payroll numbers.
You highlight something that is most significant, and everybody feels it. It's in everybody's bones, whether they can quantify it or not. It's just true. Everybody knows they're being stretched thin. And so while people may tout, hey, I got a raise, or I got a bump in pay, or hey, look, payrolls are up, it costs us all so much more to get by. And everybody knows it.
No, that's exactly right. And it's so infuriating to hear the mouthpieces of this administration talk about how the American people are receiving so much more in their paychecks. Well, congratulations, except your paycheck, despite it being bigger, can't even go as far, which is why more Americans are reporting that they're living from paycheck to paycheck. More Americans are reporting food insecurity, which is a fancy way of saying that they literally can't afford to buy enough food to eat. And so what are they doing? They're putting their grocery bills on credit cards. You know, Chris, there are companies that are popping up now, special financing firms. Literally all they do is finance grocery payments. That's what we've come to in the United States of America. In Joe Biden's America, families cannot afford to buy groceries, and so they're having to get special financing plans.
I read for the first time in my life a story in the New York Post, I don't know, last week or 2 weeks ago. I didn't bring it up here, and I meant to. It was a serious, very serious, and I'm not making fun of it. If this was you or anybody else, I understand it. It was a discussion of people hosting Thanksgiving and asking everybody to chip in a sum of money, like put some money in the pot for the host of Thanksgiving because of the cost of the dinner to put on. I've never, and again, I'm not mocking that. I'm just saying I've never read anything like that where a Thanksgiving family host is asking for contributions to pay for the dinner, underwrite the dinner.
Chris, I was just reading through last night some survey data. A quarter of Americans this holiday season have reduced the number of people they're inviting over for at least one of their holiday meals because they cannot afford to feed anybody. So again, think of this. In a country, in the richest country in the world, in a time of year when we're supposed to be celebrating and giving thanks for our abundance, we're having to cut back. That says it all.
You write something also really significant, and that is the shift in full-time jobs. Since May, 500,000 jobs since May full-time lost. That equates to an average loss of, you write, 2,600 full-time jobs per day. And that is not getting a lot of coverage, but there are, I mean, we know the tech companies are, I mean, the layoffs are tens of thousands in the tech sector right now, we've read.
Right. And again, we see this transition from full-time to part-time in terms of businesses' preferences for what they're going to hire. We see that happen before businesses transition into just no hiring at all and then just layoffs. And so some sectors obviously are moving faster than others, like tech, for example, which you just mentioned. You know, you're seeing other sectors that have much more of a lag, and that's, you know, that's frankly normal. We see that going into every recession. But this idea, again, that the economy is somehow on rock solid footing and that the labor market is healthy, I mean, it's just not true at all. Things are anemic. This labor market is running on fumes.
It's funny, E.J. Antoni at the Heritage Foundation. Reuters writes a headline that, you know, I get it. I think most of this audience probably gets it, but it's counterintuitive to a lot of people who are newer to this conversation. U.S. markets ended lower on Monday as investors are spooked by better than expected data from the services sector. So it's, you know, it's again, it's counterintuitive. Like the markets are reacting negatively to better than expected data. Can you kind of explain that to folks?
Sure. So we're in basically this really bizarre time, and this has happened before, so it's not completely unique, but it still is bizarre, where good news is bad news and vice versa. Why is that? Because the worse news we get, the more likely the Fed is to stop the interest rate hikes and to get back on the gas and start flooding the economy with printed money again. And the reason stocks love that is because stocks are what we call priced in nominal terms, meaning the price of the stock doesn't actually tell you much in terms of the worth, because you need to know how much a dollar is worth, right? Just because a stock is worth $100 doesn't tell you anything unless you know what a dollar is actually worth. And so even though the value of the dollar may go down, that will automatically cause the price of these stocks to go up. So the actual value of these stocks hasn't changed, but the price has changed. And so what do the markets want to see? They don't necessarily want to see value. They want to see price go up. And so that's what they're hoping for when we have these bad reports, that it will mean the Fed will get off the brakes and get back on the gas. But that whole situation, Chris, really speaks to how much, again, this economy right now is built on sand. The fact that we are so incredibly dependent on this cheap credit to survive tells you everything you need to know.
And I also see that prices at the gas pump have come down pretty significantly. And while we might be tempted to say, whew, that's a relief, it doesn't cost me as much to fill up my gas tank, that too, like you said, seemingly good news is not great news, because we're not producing more. We know that. The agenda of the Biden administration is not to produce more. So it's not as though more is coming into the market. So what does that mean? If the price is coming down, that means people are buying less. You know, be it industry or whatever, there's less consumption of it, which is also, I think, an indication that the economy is slowing. Is that accurate?
No, that's completely fair. And again, instead of producing more at home, instead of creating an abundance of supply, which will drive down price, we're instead killing demand to drive down price. And where are we looking for additional supply? Not Oklahoma, not Texas, not the Dakotas, not Alaska, not our offshore rigs in the Gulf. No, we're going to dictators in Venezuela. We're on our knees begging the Saudis to pump more oil for us. I mean, this is an absolute disgrace. Contrast that with Trump, who, you know, despite all of his faults, when he went overseas, no one was expecting him to come on bended knee. Instead, they treated him with a tremendous amount of respect, and instead were very wary of what he was going to do in terms of producing more oil and taking away their market share. Now we're surrendering our market share to people who, frankly, are our enemies.
EJ, the only thing we can expect at this point, and I won't even say with 100% certainty we can expect this, but okay, a Republican-controlled House through 2023 and 2024. So maybe, optimistically, the government spending will slow or stop. Maybe. Republicans like to spend money, too, so we'll wait and see. But let's assume they slow the spending. What do you see as an economist? What's your most optimistic forecast for next year? Because I remember even people like Treasury Secretary Yellen
you know, Biden administration officials, they've even been kind of saying, yeah, 23 is going to get kind of rough. I mean, it doesn't feel like even people in charge are forecasting good things.
No, absolutely. We have some very troubled waters ahead of us, you know, and unfortunately, the Republicans in Congress, especially those in the establishment, let me put it this way. The establishment Republicans are far more establishment than they are Republican. These are not inherently conservative people. And we've already seen people in leadership like Mitch McConnell announce that they intend to get on board with these multi-trillion-dollar omnibus spending packages. And so it's not enough to vote the right people into office. Whether the right or wrong people get into office, you have to exert the necessary political pressure on them to do the right thing. And I think that is the only way we get any kind of conservative and fiscally responsible budgets passed.
I mean, I've been, you know, I'm not the oldest guy around, but I've been through enough now since I've been paying attention to politics. You know, a booming economy in the 90s, you know, a crash in the early 2000s, you know, a pretty resurgent economy, then another dip, and then a huge resurgency. Now we're clearly in another decline. I know it's somewhat cyclical. I mean, do you see an upside? Do you see us getting back on top of the mountain again? Do you see another surge at some point? Or does it mean a change in direction for the country? What is it? What typically precedes improvement?
You know, if we want things to change, all we have to do is remove our current impediments to growth. Those are high taxes, burdensome regulation, and an unstable currency. I mean, we've been through this before, right? If you look at the late 1970s and early 1980s, there's the winning formula. You cut taxes, you cut regulation, and at the same time, you allow interest rates to find their natural level instead of these artificially low rates in order to pump the Treasury full of the cash that it doesn't have, thereby causing inflation. So all you have to do is just repeat that Reagan-Volcker formula, and voila, you will get stable prices and you will get robust economic growth.
And George is going to reelect Raphael Warnock today instead. So I have a feeling. I'm sorry to say, I hope I'm wrong, but I have a funny feeling that's what's coming. So we're not going to see any improvement out of that body called the Senate anytime soon, I'm sorry to say. But EJ and Tony, it's always great to catch up with you, my friend. Thank you for your analysis today.
Yeah, Chris, thank you for having me.
Have an Admiral Rachel Levine update from Breitbart. By the way, neither an admiral nor a Rachel, but I digress. Admiral Rachel Levine calls on doctors to become ambassadors to normalize transgenderism. The Biden administration's Assistant Secretary for Health, Admiral Rachel Levine. Quote, I encourage all of you to think of yourself as ambassadors to your communities, ambassadors for science, as well as ambassadors for compassion and for care. This was at the Pitt Pediatric Grand Rounds, I assume in Pittsburgh. These conversations don't need to be limited or restricted to a medical setting, the Admiral said. Offer yourselves as informational resources, not just for youth, but for school teachers and principals and school boards, professional organizations, recreation centers, county commissioners, and others who would benefit from this information and your perspective, the Admiral noted, adding, please proactively seek out opportunities to speak about what you know. The Admiral went on to say, we need to have these conversations that question the assumptions that are underlying today's attacks on trans people. Pushing back the veil of ignorance demands this extra effort. Medicine and science are being politically perverted around the country. You got that straight, Rachel. But you're doing the perverting. You see, gaslighting, the Miriam Webster's Dictionary Word of the Year, gaslighting. This is this. This is what this is. That a man dressed up as a woman in an admiral's uniform is trying to convince you that you are the politically and scientifically and medically perverted person for rejecting that this man dressed as an admiral is neither a woman nor an admiral. Going on to say, they are rejecting well-established science and simply rejecting basic human compassion. Yeah, normalize mutilation. That's compassion. Mutilate children. That's science. And call it medicine, by the way. Mutilating children and dare call it medicine. You know what the first rule of medicine is? Do no harm. First rule. Talk to anybody who's gone to med school. Do no harm. And I say again, and I'll say it till I'm dead, surgery, altering your children's bodies, does not fix their behavioral and emotional issues. Do you hear me? Altering our children's bodies does not fix their emotional and behavioral issues. You know who does? Mentally trained psychologists and psychiatrists, people trained in mental and emotional problems. And you'll note that the admiral is not calling for more emotional counseling, not calling for therapy. Why is that? Also, just a quick note, because it's just a bummer, and I don't have anything more to say about it, then it's a bummer, and I was sorry to hear it. I didn't know she was battling breast cancer. Kirstie Alley passing away yesterday. Kirstie Alley dead at 71. I did not know she was 71. She looked absolutely tremendous. I had no clue she was 71 years of age. Not that it matters at all, but I didn't know she was battling breast cancer, but her kids posted on her social media yesterday that she had succumbed to it, and apparently it was pretty aggressive, and it happened pretty quickly. But a fierce, funny, bold lady. I really enjoyed her, and she was really coming into her own voice. I know she did. I'd always kind of hoped to get her on the show because she was starting to do some kind of national talk show circuits. I know she went on Tucker's show. She went on Seb's show, and she made no bones about it. She ended up becoming a Trump acolyte toward the end. She was one of those kind of rare Hollywood types that was not apologetic about the fact that she didn't like the direction of the country. And she didn't like the direction of Hollywood, and she was not afraid to speak up about it. She was wildly funny, too. Really entertaining lady. But, yeah, so that was sad news yesterday. All right, hope you'll check out the Harumph Society. Every single week, three editions, and the Stigall Shop is open now with the Harumph mug and shirts. Go to chrisstigall.com and sign up. We'll see you tomorrow.
AM 990, The Answer.
WNTP Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.